On This Week in Enterprise Tech, we talk about VPN malware sticking it to the hackers when they're caught, and our great guest talks about the amazing feat of bringing Wi-Fi to the New York subways. Twyatt on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is TWiT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 293, recorded June 1st, 2018. Wi-Fi in the New York subway. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by LastPass. Join over 13 million LastPass users and start managing and securing your passwords today. Learn more at lastpass.com/twit and by Moogsoft. Reduce IT alerts and tickets by up to 99%. Visit Moogsoft.com to learn more and sign up for a demo. Welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that's dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how this world is connected. I'm your host for today, Louis Maresca, and I'm your guide through the world of enterprise, but I definitely do not want to guide you by myself. I need a little help from my friends, starting with Mr. Robert Ballister, Padre SJ. Robert, you've been flying around the world here. You got some miles under your belt there.
Yeah, I worked it out. So since the last time I was on Twyatt, I've clocked 22,000 miles, I think. A little overseas, ended up in Canada. Tried the poutine. It's okay. But Toronto, you're awesome.
Well, everyone has to try poutine at least once in their life, right?
It's kind of a rite of passage.
That's right. That's right. Well, of course, we can't do this show without Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior editor at Dark Reading. My dose today was beating botnets, Curtis.
That's right. There's a new federal report out on beating botnets. And, the real question is whether anyone's going to care. We get to find out. But I've been doing that. I've also been wielding concrete saws. And believe me, I'd rather be here than deal with either concrete saws or botnets. So it's a good Friday afternoon.
I care about botnets. Well, folks, we have another great show for you today. We're going to stick to what hackers are doing and how they're being punished after their crimes. And of course, we have an amazing guest to talk the amazing feat of underground Wi-Fi. But of course, first we have to start with the blips. So if you live in the EU, you may have noticed over the last day that you've been unable to pay for your stuff with your Visa card. Whether you're at a gas station, a railway station, or a store, Visa payment services were 404-ing. There really isn't a good time for payment systems being down. And in this case, it's just not just affecting some of the merchants, it's affecting all of the merchants. So this brings up an important topic about networking, failover, and regional nodes. Although there are compliance boundaries, in most cases, businesses can reach across regional lines to access higher latency nodes in their network just in case there's panic going on. Well, Visa doesn't seem to have that. Visa is doing their best to investigate, but if there's any time to be in IT and operations, now is a good one because I think Visa needs some better consultants.
Well, we've got a new botnet and some FBI recommendations that, well, might not solve the problem. Researchers from Cisco's Talos security team discovered the existence of malware they're calling VPN Filter last Wednesday. Their detailed report said the malware infected more than 500,000 devices made by Linksys, Microtik, Netgear, QNAP, and TP-Link. And originally, the FBI sent out a notice asking owners of those home routers to reboot them. Now, later, they came out and said, you know what? If you have a home router made by anyone, go ahead and reboot that sucker. The problem is that VPN Filter is a new generation of botnet malware that is persistent. That means that it has the capability to stay active after reboots. So the report from Talos said that the malware was developed by hackers working for an advanced nation state, most likely Russia. They advise users of the routers to perform a factory reset. And that's one piece that can actually give you some relief. Perform a factory reset, or even better, go out and use this as an excuse to update your firmware. Putting in a new copy of clean firmware is the actual way to make sure that it's done. So we've got a new class of malware out there. This is just the first volley, and I would say score one for the malware writers.
Now, 6 years ago, Google, still in its nigh unstoppable rise to the rarefied air of blue chip companies, passed Microsoft in market capitalization. Since then, with Google making all the right moves and Microsoft foundering with several high price tag miscalculations and acquisitions, it seemed like Microsoft was destined to forever now be the B team of tech. Well, what a difference a Nadella makes. Year over year, Microsoft stock has risen more than 40%. Bringing in the company's capitalization to $749 billion versus Alphabet's $739 billion. But anybody following the story knows that it's not just about stock value, it's about vision. And Satya Nadella has brought a web-first, services-first philosophy to the tech giant that is serving them well on Wall Street and in the enterprise. Since Nadella has taken over, Microsoft's cloud computing business went from a forgotten division on life support to a market leader far passing Google and behind only Amazon Web Services. Nadella's reorganizations, criticized and ridiculed, have moved important engineering resources from Windows and devices into cloud and AI, which are largely to thank for the stock boom. While Apple and Amazon still have larger market caps at $923 and $782 billion respectively, none of the top 10 have matched Microsoft's pace, both in stock growth and entrance into emerging markets with potential to be huge new revenue streams. Bottom line, the Nadella train is the future of Microsoft.
So distributed denial of service attacks, or DDoS, are becoming more prominent on the internet today. But who knows? This could be why the Visa service is down. Well, in the midst of all of this, there are new DDoS for hire services as well, called WebStressor.org. WebStressor is one of the most active services for launching point-to-click distributed denial of service attacks. It's what's so-called booter or stressor services, which are virtual hire muscle that anyone can rent to knock nearly any website or internet user offline. WebStressor could really be rented as little as $14.99, and the services allow people with little or to no technical knowledge to launch crippling DDoS attacks around the world. If nothing else, they actually have 136,000 registered users. And if you've noticed, I said that was one of the most active services. Well, was, because WebStressor has not now been taken down and arrests have been made. Who do you blame for this service? Well, allegedly, 19-year-old hacker Merk, who is a Serbian, Jovan Markovic. Dutch and UK authorities can call it a win for justice, but it's only a matter of time another pop-up DDoS for hire service will show its head.
Now, here's one that's not entirely enterprise tech, but it is a shout-out to our great producer, Chibert, who's off doing day job stuff today. In an example of, well, why women statistically outlive men, the Twitterverse has been asking the critical question of whether it's okay to roast marshmallows over a lava vent. And now, on the one hand, this is an example of someone trolling the U.S. Geological Survey, but the fact is people will ask these questions. Now, I live in a state where people do silly things around big toothy lizards, so I understand. But Hawaii in particular has had a lot of people going and doing silly and even stupid things with active lava flows. It's getting to the point where Hawaii counties are examining on a case-by-case basis whether or not to charge idiots for being rescued. Even Sir Richard Branson managed to write a check to the folks who rescued him when his balloon crashed into Kilauea Crater. That's the same Kilauea Crater that's now spewing some huge ash clouds and has beautiful active fountaining. Reality is that trying to take a steam bath, treating the ocean like a hot tub, or thinking your drone is going to survive a trip through the superheated air over a lava vent all fall into the category of a great big no. And the big question is it safe to go to the Big Island? The answer is a resounding yes. Active venting covers a truly tiny but very visually spectacular portion of the Big Island. And that area of the island, well, the name literally means lava goes here. So don't stop visiting Hawaii. Get out there. Give a shout out to Chebert. Just don't expect to get up close and personal with lava vents and your bag of marshmallows.
Now, it's been almost 5 years since Twyatt first discussed the use of dirt boxes, stingrays, or IMSI catchers. These are surveillance devices that allow an attacker to spoof cell phone towers, acting as a man in the middle in any wireless conversation, bypassing most basic encryption schemes for cell phones. Now, it wasn't a new type of attack, but the ever-growing sophistication and falling price of software-defined radios made these devices affordable even for casual hackers. In a world where most of us just assume our communications are secure, Twyatt warned us that the dirt box would be long-lived. Well, a report from the Department of Homeland Security has confirmed just that. Yesterday, DHS released a study that found an alarming number of unidentified stingrays operating in close proximity to the White House and other sensitive locations in Washington, D.C. The study pointedly did not mention if the boxes were being used by U.S. law enforcement, private citizens, or foreign entities, but their desire to keep the news quiet seems to bolster the idea that at least a few of them are being used by the U.S. intelligence community. Alone, that's alarming. But what's even more alarming is the recently confirmed news that the president has refused to use specially configured secure communications devices and is instead using two iPhones for many of his communications needs. Folks, it's not paranoia if we have proof that they're out to get us.
So you remember the Tor browser, right? Well, it bounces your communications around a distributed network of relays run by volunteers around the world in order to help prevent somebody from watching your internet connection and learning the sites that you're visiting. Well, the Tor browser is based on the extended supported release ESR version of Firefox, which is a less disruptive than the continuous patching version of the mainline Firefox. Well, even so, it takes a ton of time to rebase the Tor browser patchers to the new version of Firefox whenever it comes out. Well, Mozilla is about to make it easier. They're starting the new Tor Uplift project, where Mozilla will start integrating Tor's patches into Firefox directly as part of the new movement. Firefox also has adopted a new security feature from Tor, such as first-party isolation and preventing tracking cookies across domains. Think those creepy Facebook ads that show up when you surf around, as well as your fingerprint resistance, which means it blocks pieces of entropy and ID you as you go across the web. Well, that's not all. Well, I kind of feel like an infomercial here, but Mozilla's taking the next step, where they're actually forwarding and introducing their project Fusion. This means the fingerprint resistance is built in, proxy bypass framework, as well as the Tor proxy. And they have what they call real private browsing mode, coined super private mode. If anything else, this might just be Firefox's competitive edge upon all the other browsers. Now just to convince Apple to let anything but Safari and JavaScript Core on iOS. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, the bites. But first, we have to thank a great supporter of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's LastPass. I use LastPass so often, I don't even know I'm using it anymore. It's one of my favorite tools. Think about it. You have a username and password for every site you go to. For me, I have 5 banks, so I'm supposed to use different username and passwords for each and every one of those sites, and it becomes almost impossible for me to remember these things. And if you don't write the passwords on a sticky note, because you don't want people to find that, and of course you may lose it, and you don't want people to store it in their plain text or in their email because that's just a bad idea, well, that's where LastPass comes in and saves us all. LastPass automatically remembers and fills in your passwords anytime, anywhere on your computer or your mobile device. All you have to do is remember that master password, and LastPass remembers the rest. I got hooked on LastPass just on my desktop, but it was so useful. I started using it on all my devices, every one of them. And I used the browser add-ins as well, Chrome, Edge, Firefox, Opera, and support, and more. And plus, they work great on Android and iOS. I remember the day I was at work, and my family actually called me, and they said, hey, we need the password to the bank account because we need to make a payment. Of course, did I remember it? Absolutely not. And all I had to do is use my one and only MasterPass, visit LastPass Vault, and bam, I could give them the password. LastPass has literally saved me time, and time is money for me. And now, of course, I'm talking about my personal LastPass account, but they also offer LastPass Family for the entire family, and LastPass also works amazing for Enterprise too. Enterprises are always battling people trying to breach their networks. Of course, you know, 81% of breaches today are caused by weak passwords, and people are breaking into your machines and using you to bridge and leak your data. Close that door right now. LastPass will fix this. It will protect the passwords for your entire organization. It makes password sharing easy and secure. All that sensitive data is encrypted on the device level. I am a LastPass user for life. I love it. At work and at home, fix your password woes with LastPass, the number one most preferred password manager. Learn more at LastPass.com/twit today. That's LastPass.com/twit to see which product is right for you. And we thank LastPass for supporting This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, let's jump into the bites. So you remember those 500 million accounts that were stolen from Yahoo last year? Well, it's thanks to people like Cameron Baratoff. So don't think this is his first rodeo either, though. Baratoff would go and register domains, whether I think he has 81 to his name. Some are just email provider references, such as accounts, google.net or yandex.com. And also he has just plain old email hacking services like infotechteam.com. And he would market them as quality mail hacking to order without changing the password. And the service basically charged $60 per password. He even had antimail.org, which is another domain. And he basically advertised quality mail hacking to order. Well, how was he doing it? Was it some magic hardwired into some chip? Well, nope. Baratoff would rely on spear phishing emails that he would target individuals by using personalized information. He would have links to sites that had fake or but familiar login pages. Users might actually type in their username and password, but they also let the attacker do is steal their cookies, which are sometimes little hidden files that are given by sites and stored on your machine. And sometimes they store whether you've been authenticated with a site or not before. So according to his other sites, he also had xssmail.com, and he used techniques as XSS or cross-site scripting, which would rely on vulnerabilities of the website to not properly parse the data submitted by visitors, as well as, along with XSS, he also had cookie-stealing exploits, which these could be collected by another accuser. And that particular accuser is another Russian national called Alexei Belin. And he would actually use those cookies by that person. In the Yahoo case, though, once an employee was phished, the hackers got in and they unlocked all the other accounts. So what was Karim's charges here for doing all this? Well, he had 47 criminal charges that included conspiracy, computer fraud, economic espionage, theft of trade secrets, and aggravated identity theft. Karim did agree to the plea agreement, though. He admitted he hacked at least 80 webmail accounts on behalf of the FSB, which is the Federal Security Service of Russian Federation, which is essentially Russian's version of FBI. He also admitted to 11,000 webmail accounts since 2010. So what happened to that assisting Yahoo accounts stolen, you know, those half a billion Yahoo accounts? Well, what did he get for all this? This past week, he was sentenced to 5 years in prison and $2.2 million. Fine, which is $250,000 for each account. What did the Justice Department seek? 8 years. 8 years. That's it. Plus, they can't even seize his assets in Canada since he's a 23-year-old kid. He actually made his first $1 million at the age of 15. Okay, so there's many different, numerous angles we could talk about here. But I first want to start with the phishing part. So, Curtis, I remember reading in multiple of your articles about phishing and how even social media now is one of the highest attack services rather than email. Is this just an ongoing effort? There's just going to be more and more pop-up ways of phishing information for people?
Oh, absolutely. As you say, social media, I won't say that it has passed email phishing yet, but it is certainly growing very rapidly, and a number of experts feel that it is the more serious challenge at this point. In addition, we're hearing terms like smishing used. That's phishing activity using SMS messages, and whishing, which is phishing activity using WhatsApp. So the bad guys are turning to all kinds of communication channels in order to try and get people to give up personally identifiable information. The big reason for that is that, in general, the education efforts around email phishing have been at least reasonably successful. So, pardon me, you really have to send out lots and lots of email messages or spend time to develop a truly compelling spear phishing campaign in order to make email a viable channel. It's just going to keep growing, though, because regardless of how it leaves the organization or leaves the individual, that personal information is a very valuable commodity.
Right. Now, we had a guest back a while back, Ray Pompon from F5. He had talked about phishing and how he actually pointed out that it's really hard to fully educate people since the bad guys are essentially con men and they just use psychological warfare against people. And so I don't know if there's really an easy way to do this. In fact, I remember even seeing phishing USBs where people would just leave USBs in some kind of random place. People would take them, pick them up and use them because they were quote unquote free. So I think the question here is, Padre, you know, what how can we protect ourselves here? Like what can we possibly do in this day and age?
We can't. Okay, no, let me continue though. And but that really is an honest answer. This is just like the conversation we had at the start of TWiET, because if you remember 6 years ago, we were really starting to make that transformation from perimeter security to a more holistic model of security. In other words, you just have to assume that the attackers are going to get inside the walls. This and all the current attempts to stop phishing are perimeter security. We're saying, okay, we're going to stop people from getting phished. We're going to stop people from falling for these scams. That will never happen. You will never be able to do that because of human nature. Some of us are just going to fall for scams. Some of them are really good scams. Some of them are convincing scams. I mean, this is what these people do professionally. So the only real response is to make that same sort of transformation. You have to move from this perimeter security view of securing your users to just assuming that at some point your users are going to give up credentials, your users are going to get hacked, they are going to get owned, their devices are going to get compromised, and you need to be able to have a security model that can survive that. Until we do that, this is all just theater. Because I remember the interview we did with F5, where we discussed much of the same thing. And at that point, we were talking about the USB sticks that people were leaving on the ground. And then someone would say, oh, hey, free USB drive. They'd plug it in, and now their computer is owned. That sort of attack will never disappear. So what are you doing for your employees to A, educate them so that they're less susceptible to fall for these scams, and then B, assuming that they will fall for the scams to make sure that their access to information has graded levels of security so that even if they surrender one set of credentials, it's not giving away the whole farm.
Right, right. Those are good suggestions. Hey, Curtis, is there anything else we can do here?
Well, I just wanted to add to what Padre said, because, you know, we teach people to do things like hover their mouse over a URL to see if it really goes to the display string, things like that. But the bad guys are ever more sophisticated, because I've seen many more Unicode attacks lately. You know, we're used to the characters being encoded in ASCII, so that there's a specific numerical value for each code. Well, you can use Unicode and display something that has very little to do with the ASCII representation. So you can hover, it will show up being just right. When you click on it, it goes to someplace on the dark web. As Padre said, we're never going to eliminate this. That's why what we really need is a combination of education, procedure, policy, and technology that gives us the layers required to at least knock our organization off the list of low-hanging fruit for these criminals.
Right. So let me address the elephant in the room here, because this is kind of the strange part of this. And so this particular hacker was only sentenced, with all the things that he did, he was only sentenced for 5 years. That's it. And a $2.5 million fine, which he has money up the wazoo hidden somewhere that he can pay with. So 5 years is really nothing for a 23-year-old. You know, Padre, is this the right message we're trying to send to hackers? Like, you steal half a billion passwords and expose a half a billion people, you just get 5 years.
Yeah. And, you know, we can go back and forth on this. I'm just going to speak for myself. I'm speaking for my own personal opinion on how you do this sort of sentencing. You have to set the sentencing to encourage the behavior that you want. And, set aside all the politics here and what happened. What we actually want out of people like this who do have skills is we want them to be good citizens of the internet. We want them to use their skills productively, beneficially for everybody else. So a fine and some jail time that is probably going to get commuted down, and down is really not going to do what you want it to do. The way that you hurt people like this is you take away their access to the thing that they love the most. You give them an incredible sentence, a ridiculous sentence, a 40-year sentence, and you suspend it and say, you can't use a computer. You cannot be connected to a network for the next 10 years. That's basically a life sentence for a person like this. It takes them away from their livelihood. It takes them away from the thing that they love. That's actually going to be far more of a detriment, of a deterrence to people who might do this sort of behavior than saying, yeah, I'm going to fine you some arbitrary amount, which you probably already have stashed away, and I'm going to give you a prison sentence that I know you're not going to really serve. So that's just me. And when you see me at DEF CON in August and you don't agree with me, feel free to come on up. We'll have a beer and discuss it.
Absolutely. I think a slap. It seems like to me this guy's laughing as he kind of walks into prison here. He's getting a slap on the wrist. Curtis, what do you think? What's the best course of action here? Do we need to send the right message somewhere?
Well, I think we absolutely do need to send the right message. I'm with Padre. I'm not sure that this does it, but I also am not sure that our current laws really have a mechanism that works against criminals like this. I think it's worth pointing out that he was one of four people indicted. He's the only one of the four who will ever do any time because the other three are Russian nationals living in Russia, and two of them are agents of the FSB. So we know that nothing is going to happen to them. So what we have are four indicted individuals, one cops a guilty plea, and for the entire episode in which over a billion records were compromised, we have this result. I don't think this really discourages much of anyone, especially when there are the amounts of money floating around. And I've got to say, in reading about this pre-sentencing hearing, I got to love his attorney, who basically said his defense is that he was just doing so darn much hacking. You know, someone who hacks as much as he does really couldn't have known that this was the Russian government asking him to do it. So he's less culpable because he did more and worse things. I love the world of the legal argument.
Absolutely. So what about Yahoo here? Like, I think we've talked about this in a little bit in the past, but Yahoo is really not really being held accountable other than maybe their stock drop here. I think, is that really enough? Like, should companies like Yahoo or whoever, these other companies, we talked about breaches in the past that have leaked disinformation, you know, obviously people can bring civil cases against them, right? Padre, I think, is that enough to kind of send the right message here? I don't think it is.
It's not, but we do have an example right now of something that may be enough, and that's the GDPR. So over in the EU, they have fully implemented, well, supposedly, the GDPR regulations, which will allow them to fine companies who do not properly protect their customers' data up to 4% of their net. That's not a slap on the hand. That is a full-on salvo in the face. Now, of course, that's just in the EU, and we are still trying to figure out all the ways that this is going to go wrong. We know there's going to be a lot of things we have to tweak. But what I love about this is that in 3-4 years, the United States can look at what happens with GDPR and say, okay, this is what worked. This is what didn't work. This is what we're going to implement. Bold step by the EU, and I think a necessary step. All of their missteps are going to help us, the entire networked community, in the long run.
Right. Well, hopefully we get it under control, because I think there's, you know, companies need to be held accountable, and of course, so do the people that are doing the breaches. So I think it's time to figure out something and do some legislation here. Well, folks, that does it for the Bites. Next up, of course, we bring a guest and drop some knowledge on the Twiat riot. But first, we also have to thank another sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's MOOCsoft. And as an engineer for working over a decade in cloud services and SaaS services, I can tell you right now from personal experience that working on the same alert in the same instance as another engineer is a huge time waster, especially if it can become very expensive. Ops teams end up looking into it only to find out they need to engage development, but then they call the wrong team. They end up calling a different dev team, and then that dev team gets another alert, and they look into it. It just becomes a complete mess. Guess who suffers? Well, your customers do, because you're taking too long to figure things out, all the while the system's running and they're using it, and then they run into the issue, and then they create a support ticket. So this is one of the many advantages of using MOOCsoft AI Ops. It's artificial intelligence for IT operations. They have a patented noise reduction technology, no rules or filters. They manage the flood of alerts for you. They can literally reduce your alerts by up to 99%. Not only that, it integrates with just about everything. Node.js, AppDynamics, Splunk, Oracle OEM, AWS Cloud, Azure tools, and more. And it's extensible, which means you can easily integrate your system into it because it uses standard mechanisms like REST API, webhooks, SMP, and more. Plug your data streams into it and get it working for you. MOOCsoft is really the one-stop shop for IT and dev organizations because it analyzes, manages, and routes the fire hose of alerts to make it more manageable. This type of system really is kind of a gift for your system, for your services, because if you think about it, it makes it so small or large organizations can scale their service and their IT business. It makes it so you can achieve full visibility across your entire technology stack without any blind spots. MOOCsoft can even look for patterns and provide root cause for any incoming situation. It can even reuse tribal knowledge automatically to help resolve issues quickly by using supervised machine learning. Not that I need to give you any more proof, but you probably heard of that global IT managed service provider, HCL Technologies. Well, they included MOOCsoft Ops in their award-winning Dry Ice platform, which they use in their event management layer. Not only does this help their organization reduce ops workflow, but it also helped them reduce detect-to-correct time throughout the life of the incident ticket. And how well did MOOCsoft work for HCL? Well, it actually helped reduce their mean time to restore by 33%. And what does that mean? Well, it means that they can support more customers with high service quality, all the while also keeping their operating costs low and their efficiency high. With MOOCsoft AI Ops, you can reduce your IT alerts and tickets up to 99% right now. Visit MOOCsoft.com to get a demo. That's MOOCsoft.com. And we thank MOOCsoft for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, of course, we get to my favorite part of the show, and that's we get to bring a guest in to the Twilight Riot to drop some knowledge on us. And of course, he is a 25-year veteran in the IT business. He has had tons of roles, software developer, marketing, sales, but currently he's leading vertical strategy for Octel Lucent Enterprises North America. We welcome to This Week in Enterprise Tech, Rob Hemerick. Rob, welcome. Thank you for coming on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks for having me, Lou. Nice to be here.
Absolutely. So first, we're super excited to have you here because we have a really fun topic to talk about. But first, before we get there, we do want to hear a little bit about you, how you got into the tech industry and what kind of led you to Octel Lucent.
Well, you know, it's been a long journey for me. Engineering degree, did some dev work for a little company called Newbridge Networks back in the day. Through a series of mergers, acquisitions, and spinoffs, I find myself still here in Ottawa, Ontario, working for Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise, a company of about 2,100 people worldwide operating in over 50 countries. But you're looking at my home office here, so this is where I work.
Fantastic. Well, I mean, the topic that we have today is super amazing, super cool. And we heard just a little bit about it recently, about the new wireless capabilities within the New York subways. You know, what do they do? What do you do for planning even this type of thing in that type of environment?
I mean, it's a multi-year process. And, you know, I need to explain, I think, that, you know, Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise has a really key component of the technology here, but the real brains behind the design of New York City subways wireless system is Transit Wireless. They're the folks who designed it and are currently operating it for the next 27 years as a right to use that they have for the system. But they took a really systematic approach to building this network. They started with a small pilot in West Chelsea, six stations to pilot it, to make sure they had the architecture right, to make sure the service worked as intended. And once they were happy with what they had, then they started to roll it out bit by bit. And, you know, when you're trying to deliver wireless coverage to 270 plus stations, you know, in an infrastructure that's over 100 years old, that's not an easy thing to do. So they took their time, but they actually finished well ahead of schedule. And all of the stations are now lit up. That was as of the end of 2016. So they have a system now that is used by 300,000 people every day in New York City. So it's a very, very wide ranging and a very smart kind of deployment that Transit Wireless has done.
So other than the obvious, there's obviously you have to think a little bit differently from just the normal terrestrial wireless communications above ground and underground. So, you know, what do you have to do? What's the type of environment? What do you have to do? What kind of hardware do you have to put in there that's different than the normal installations and the normal kind of deployments for that type of thing?
Yeah, no, it's an excellent question. I don't know if anyone of your listeners or any of you guys have been inside a New York City subway station. But these places are not environmentally controlled. They get really hot in the summer. They get really cold in the winter. And so the equipment you deploy to operate a wired and wireless network has to have, you know, industrial levels of operating temperature. So the equipment they used from Alcatel-Lucent Enterprise is what we call hardened Ethernet. The switches there operate from a range of minus 40 Celsius all the way up to 74 Celsius. And when you install wireless and switches in the ceiling of a subway system, it can get that hot. It can get that cold. And so you have to really think it through. The other thing that's interesting about deploying in an underground environment is it's open to the public. So, you know, imagine if you're an IT pro, imagine that if all your network closets were open to anyone who felt like, you know, taking a look inside to see what was going on, you can imagine what would happen. So what Transit Wireless did is they actually enclosed all of the network equipment in, you know, tamper-proof enclosures that are very difficult to get into and are extremely rugged. The way they clean the subway walls and ceilings is with a high-pressure hose. So, you know, those enclosures got to stand up to that, and the equipment inside has to stand up to the extreme temperatures you're going to find in there.
Right. So, you know, the type of equipment I'm seeing, obviously they you're saying a little bit about how they're enclosed, but the type of equipment I'm seeing is actually there's some even more hardened switches that we're talking about here, right? The Alcatel-Lucent switches, which are the 6855s. What makes them so useful in this type of environment and being able to be enclosed in such an environment?
Yeah, I mean, they're designed right from the get-go to be able to operate at these extreme temperatures. So, you know, your listeners will probably be aware of that if you build a PCB, there's all kinds of components you can place on it. There are mil-spec components you can put on it, which operate at extended temperature ranges. So that's what we built and we continue to build in all of our hardened Ethernet line. The other thing that's really important in this environment is to avoid anything with a moving part in it. So all of these hardened Ethernet switches are able to do what they do without fans. So this gives them a very long lifespan. And when you don't have moving parts, you end up with a very highly reliable switch. That's really critical in this kind of environment because sometimes these switches are deployed in places that you can't get to unless you're stopping the train traffic. And clearly that's not something you ever want to do when you're dealing with a public transit system that's you know, moving that many people every day.
Right. So another interesting thing is, you know, obviously you're in this kind of strange environment. You're underground. You know, how do you handle things like, you know, failure? How do you do failover? How do you handle the ability to, you know, if one switch goes down, you need to be able to kind of fail over to the other? What type of things can you do here to support that?
Yeah, I mean, it's in some cases you can't even build in redundancy because of the environment just doesn't allow it. So, you know, the first line of defense is having equipment that's installed that has very, very high MTBF numbers, mean time between failure. And you do that by what I talked about earlier, the rugged components and the fanless operation is critical. But once you've got that in place, then you're going to have options with respect to your architecture. So if your Ethernet infrastructure, like ours does, has things like link aggregation, link redundancy, being able to dual home your edge network into the core, these are all really important attributes. And when you're talking about the types of devices that we deployed here, they're essentially IT class switches that have been hardened to work in this environment. So as an IT class switch, you get all the switching, you get all the routing you would expect in any kind of closet deployment or any kind of data center deployment. It's the same kind of hardware and software running on these switches that we've deployed underground for the subway.
Right. And you talked a little bit about redundancy. So what about monitoring? What kind of support do you have to do here? What kind of telemetry do you have to use? You know, what kind of monitoring services do you have to build in to be able to handle whether things are going well or not?
Yeah, I mean, Transit Wireless, you know, these guys are the experts in not only designing, building, but also operating a network like this. And so every single piece of the network is being monitored from one of their data centers, and they have multiple ones across the city. And what's important here is that they use, you know, standard off-the-shelf tools. They expect all of their vendors to use standard off-the-shelf protocols to manage them. So that's what we do, right? So they've got their trouble ticketing, their network monitoring, their network configuration, all set up in their data centers. And of course, all of the equipment that they deploy is remotely manageable, remotely configurable, remotely troubleshootable, to invent a word for you.
I think it's a word. But I think that's interesting. I think one thing that we have to, that most systems have to worry about too, especially in these types of environments, is obviously these devices, these pieces of hardware, they need to be updated. They need to be upgraded. They need to be consistently kept up to speed, especially for security purposes. You know, what types of things do you have to do here to make sure that the system can kind of stay up to date without kind of painting you into a corner?
Well, yeah, I mean, that's really important, right? So, you know, the software updating is, of course, critical. You know, we heard all kinds of hair-raising stories earlier in the show about all kinds of security breaches. And, you know, the switches are all, of course, remotely upgradable. If they're configured in such a way, you can actually do it with a very limited service downtime. So all of this kind of feature set is really important when you're dealing in a mission-critical network like what Transit Wireless has built for New York City Subway. You need to be able to stay ahead, and you need to be able to maintain all this stuff. And you know, a lot of vendors who operate in this space, in rugged Ethernet in particular, you know, they make very very cheap and very dumb switches, and we feel that that's not really appropriate as we start to connect more and more things into these networks. And you know, Transit Wireless has built things like you know, the subway dwell times, so the signs that you see on the platform, their help points go through these networks, so they're not interested in having a network that isn't highly reliable and highly maintainable. It's critical to the operation of what they do for New York City Subway.
Right. So you talked about it a little bit before, how, you know, I had to deal with the fact that these are running stations, this is a running line, you have to deal with people being there. You know, what kind of timeline did they have when they are actually designing the system and, you know, kind of putting it in there and taking over all the legacy systems? Like what did they have to do to get it in there, and how long did they have?
Well, you know, that's funny. You know, there wasn't actually a legacy system to begin with, right? So when they started this project, you know, in I think it was 2012, there was no cell service down there. There was no Wi-Fi down there. So they were dealing with a very old architecture and infrastructure down there. You know, the New York City subway tunnels, some of them are over a century old. So, you know, that's a very challenging environment that they needed to work in. You know, so they started slowly. And over the course of just about 4 years, they rolled out Wi-Fi, 3G, 4G services to all of their subway stations. So all 276 over the course of that time. So, yeah, I mean, you have to get your your work crews down there when there's availability. There's very, very little downtime in the subway system. So this is why it takes quite a long time to build that. And when you want to build it once, and you don't want to have to go back and, you know, replace something that, oh, you know, wrong architecture, wrong switch, you know, or a fail, any kind of equipment failure. It's just not cost effective to go back and redo. It's not the same environment at all as you get in a carpeted enterprise, right?
Right. Well, I see my co-hosts, they're chomping at the bit here in the chat room. And they want to ask some questions. I think throw it over to you first, Curtis. You had some questions about, you know, lessons learned from deployment.
Yeah, it's one of the great wonderful things about the deployment you're talking about is the robust nature of the technology in the face of what is a very challenging environment. Now, we keep hearing that wireless can be the broadband replacement for cabled connections in a lot of instances, but there's always the question about reliability. You know, mm-hmm. Can an RF deployment really be as robust as that big piece of wire that comes to my apartment or my house? Do you see any lessons learned in this deployment that give us hope or that could be transferred to some of these wider deployments?
Well, you know, Curtis, it's interesting because, you know, we focus on, you know, the wireless aspect of, and that's what customers see, right? They go into a subway system and they log on to an AP called Transit Wireless, and away they go. They can surf the internet. But the reality is that this entire infrastructure is backhauled over an extensive fiber network that extends for hundreds of miles throughout the island of Manhattan and the boroughs of New York. And there's an amazing amount of wired infrastructure that's supporting this wireless backend. You know, having said that, they also have a public safety wireless network in there as well using licensed spectrum. So, you know, that's an important attribute. So, you know, to answer the question, you know, I think there is some use of wireless for critical applications, but you know, when you're dealing with the kind of bandwidth and the amount of traffic that's going through these stations, I was looking at the wireless website before we joined today. They're up to 500 terabits a month. That's on the public Wi-Fi network. You know, you need the wired backhaul to handle all of that and to provide the high user experience that Transit Wireless has become famous for inside the subway system.
Right. So I think Padre also wanted to ask something about deployment as well.
Yeah, I actually had a question about the hardening procedure that you did, because you mentioned a few things that I love. The fact that you took the fans out of the switches and made sure that they could properly diffuse heat on their own, because that's mm-hmm. important. Moving parts are parts that will wear down. Was there something that surprised you? Because this is something I've seen whenever I've done industrial installations, which is I might harden my switches, maybe I'll harden my APs, I might even use hardened conduit, but there's always something I didn't think about that breaks because I did not expect it to wear in an industrial environment because it doesn't wear in a traditional IT environment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of what the lessons learned at the initial deployment in the pilot phase, I think the enclosures actually went through a couple of iterations to get it right. You know, the early days of the deployment, you know, there was a lot of learning going on as to what exactly needed to be done in order to, you know, deploy this in a robust way and in a way that the weakest part of your architecture wasn't going to fail. So I believe there was some modifications done on the enclosure side as things went on. But from an IT electronics perspective, no, I think the architecture they started with is what they ended up with, at least from where we played in the deployment.
Let me ask a follow up on that. From the perspective of our audience, we've got IT people in the Twiat Riot. They are all mostly traditional IT people. They work in enterprise environments and office buildings and campuses. At some point, many of them might be asked to do an industrial deployment. What kind of wisdom could you give to them? So, I mean, of course, you're going to plan out your network like you always would, making sure you understand what resources are required, what type of equipment you need to move in. Then you can start looking at hardening the equipment that you're going to need to move in. But what can you give them from your experience of mistakes made about something that they should consider that they wouldn't in their regular job?
That's an outstanding question. I mean, I think, you know, one of the things that we've learned as we've done deployments in different industries that require hardened Ethernet is a couple of things, right? What we're finding is people who traditionally deploy these kinds of networks think of Ethernet as just kind of a commodity. Hey, let's just throw something in, light up the port and be done with it. But what we're finding more and more is that with all of the devices connecting into these networks from different departments, different use cases, different applications, you need to consider things like extensive power over Ethernet budgets. You need to think about things like being able to do in-service software upgrades. You need to think about things like, okay, I got, you know, 8 ports or 24 ports out there at the edge right now. How do I expand it if I need to? Because, you know, remember that you're deploying in environments that can be very expensive to access and to make changes to. So you want to put something at the edge that works and will continue to work for the next 5 to 10 years, if possible. And the way you do that is by making sure you've got, you know, the bandwidth you need out there. So, you know, gigabit to the edge, 10 gig up. You want extensive power over Ethernet with high power over Ethernet, because that's something we see a lot now in industrial applications where you get, you know, extensive pan tilt zoom cameras, for instance, who need this kind of high power to allow them to operate at these extreme temperatures. You got to build heaters into these things, right? And the only way to do that effectively is with power over Ethernet. So, you know, when you're planning it out, know what devices are connecting today, but also plan ahead, because with all of these kinds of smart city applications, with all these kinds of new outdoor things connecting into the infrastructure, it's almost a guarantee that you're going to need more than you think you do on day zero.
Yeah, no, and that's what always kills a project. That's what causes the overrun, because you said, oh, wait, yeah, I have to put a heater in my switch because it freezes in this tunnel and it's going to destroy the equipment. That's something that I would not consider if I'm just doing an office building deployment. So, and Specs in our chat room, he's a longtime member of the Twilight Riot. He's asking about budgeting lessons. And I think that's a good place to go. What would you say if a standard deployment for a 10,000 seat enterprise is X, what would you ballpark them to budget when they're doing a more hardened installation in something like a subway tunnel? If we've got X, what is that?
Yeah, it's at least 30 to 40% higher, right? Wow. You should always budget for that. I mean, that's a given, right? The thing is that the market is dominated by folks who try to stick to X today,
yep.
Right? But you end up paying the price because you might end up with a device that maybe isn't manageable or maybe has some kind of crappy web interface, or it doesn't do high power over Ethernet, or, oh, you wanted to upgrade the software in that, you're going to have to take that down for 10 minutes now while you reboot it and so forth. So, you know, it'd have a fan in it. And, you know, instead of having a million hours between failures, you have 10,000 hours between failures. And a year later, you're back in that cabinet or on a roadside or wherever you've deployed this thing and having to replace it again. And the cost of maintaining it suddenly makes your cost savings that you got up front not seem so important anymore.
Right. Yeah, it's one thing to say, well, this switch it's supposed to have 5,000 hours on it, and if it gives me 4,000 hours, that's fine. I'll forklift upgrade it. But if it's in the middle of a subway tunnel that's underwater, it's not easily accessed without shutting down some major infrastructure. So that has to be part of the budgeting. It has to be, that switch is worth $1 million. That's how much it will actually cost to replace it. So that has to be represented in the budget. And I think that's probably one of the more fascinating parts for me, because we all know how to do deployments, but doing deployments under difficult situations, that's a fun kind of challenge, actually.
Yeah, no, I couldn't have said it better, actually. I mean, the cost of you know, forklift upgrades after the fact is far, far higher than the price premium you're going to pay for, you know, deploying a properly architected hardened Ethernet switch at the beginning. I couldn't agree more.
So speaking of the test of time, we talked about this a little bit. You know, the Transit Wireless System, they won awards for this approach, right? Why did they win awards? What kind of things did they do that was so unique that they actually won awards for this?
Well, yeah, I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, so Transit just won the IDC Smart City Award, you know, for digital accessibility. So, you know, IDC, the analyst community, they recognize Transit Wireless's efforts in bringing wireless to the masses in difficult conditions. So, you know, that was the latest of a string of awards they did. But, you know, let me explain a really cool application that Transit Wireless has done in partnership with the New York Public Library System. So they had a promotion where you were able to download an ebook that was tailored to the time of your transit based on, you know, where you were and how long your commute was in the mornings. So in partnership with the New York Public Library, if you were joined the Transit Wireless Network on the subway platform, you could download a free ebook to enjoy as you did your morning or evening commute on the New York City subway system. But it's little things like that are being recognized, you know, by the analyst community, by, you know, all kinds of organizations. And awarding Transit Wireless some really you know, good hardware and well deserved hardware, I would say as well. So yeah, I mean it's been a really interesting you know, result that Transit Wireless has realized. They set out to build a smart city network, a wireless network that they could deploy all kinds of great applications on. And you know, and doing it correctly meant, you know, maybe paying a little bit more upfront for it, but in the end, it's starting to reap the benefits. And, you know, they're rolling out more and more applications on this infrastructure. I was just reading about a pilot they're doing in the tunnels now. So they're trying to extend their wireless network into the tunnels, which, you know, adds a whole different level of complexity into the system, which, you know, is really exciting. You know, you don't want to be without your YouTube videos while you're in the tunnels, right? I mean, this is something they're trying to solve. And but honestly, it's more for public safety, right? So being able to have cellular access down through the tunnels, that's also very important. So, you know, this is their latest technology challenge, but I'm sure Transit Wireless is up to it.
I've got two questions, but I want to start with sort of a throwaway. I know that you took a look at the metrics. 500 terabytes is ridiculous, first of all, but also, do you have a breakdown of that at all? That's just my curiosity. How much of it is YouTube? How much of it is Twitch? How much of it is email? Are you breaking down the protocols at all?
I'm sure in the Transit Wireless Operations Center they are. You know, one statistic I've seen from them is 74,000 hours of YouTube every month. but beyond that, no, I'm sure that you know, they have a very good understanding of how their network is being used today. They certainly make it easy for their users to use it. You know, they only authenticate once, and then the system remembers them throughout their I believe their every visitor on their system gets, I think, 3 hours without having to reauthenticate, which is really handy, you know, if you're coming onto the subway and, yeah, you know, just wanting to get on and, you know, see a video or read your email. That's a really nice little feature they've built into it.
Right. And then one that's a bit more forward-looking, the law of unintended upgrades is basically what this is, which is whenever you have a system like a subway that has been around a long time or an industrial facility and you put in a state-of-the-art communication system, there is always the desire and the temptation to start adding functionality to that. Like, well, as long as we've got this communication system, why don't we put this network on it and the safety network and the sensor network? Did you put thought into that when you were building this network? Did you tell them, look, this will never be your primary safety network because we cannot guarantee that it will work properly if it's also doing 500 terabytes of data for YouTube? What kind of conversation did you have to have with the client to make sure they understood that you were custom building the network for a particular function?
Well, you know, the what is true about the Transit Wireless Network is that every bit that goes in and out of that subway system is going through one of our switches. And it's the switches that we deployed from the get-go of the project. But, you know, these aren't, as I've intimated, they're not low-end switches. These are switches that have very high capacity and very high throughput. So, you know, they're up to the challenge. And also bear in mind that the numbers we're talking about are aggregate numbers across the entire system. So any one subway station itself, you know, isn't running 500 terabits, of course. But all that being said, Transit deployed a network that they wanted to be able to add things to over time, right? As an example, you know, something that wasn't in the original plan was these subway wait time signs that they put on platform. Okay. So you've all seen them. You know, you stand on the platform, you look up and you see the sign that says, okay, your next train will be here in 4 minutes or whatever it is. This is actually a network application that they built after the fact. And it's all based on Bluetooth. So they've put dongles on the trains and dongles at the entrance and exits of the tunnels. And based on when that gets triggered, they're able to tell, okay, you know, I know what speed the train's at. I know how far it is to the next station. I can now realistically put a believable number for passengers to know what's coming up. And that wasn't originally in the plans, right? And they anticipated new applications without even knowing what they were when they got started. And, you know, we anticipate they'll be able to do that, you know, for the next few years as well. But, you know, of course, when it comes time and every network ages out, you know, we hope to be there again to, you know, provide them with the next generation of hardened equipment.
Well, you know, we've been talking about all of the next gen stuff that you're putting in place, all of the very advanced technology that went into this deployment. But as we've been talking and as you've been giving your answers, my eye has been drawn to the CRT just over your left shoulder there in your home office. And, you know, that still does a fine job of displaying an image from a computer. So I think my next question is, were there any, let's call it classic technology pieces that went into this deployment that might be surprising, you know, things that are not necessarily cutting edge that have actually been part of deployments for a while that are still doing the job and still part of this very high demand, very critical wireless network?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely, right? I mean, this network that they've deployed is a full layer two network. It has, you know, features that IT pros have seen for years, like link aggregation, you know, things that are kind of just taken as table stakes, right? They could have routed the network. The architecture they deployed could have been routed as well, but they chose to switch it. So, you know, the thing that's a little bit unusual, and again, you know, if you're not as accustomed to the hardened Ethernet space, some of these features that, you know, we as IT pros kind of take for granted are not always found in these kinds of switches. You know, like things like, you know, we do a lot of work in transit, you know, so departments of transportation, they really like a protocol called Ethernet Ring Protection, ERP. It's been around forever, right? But not many hardened switches support that kind of protocol. So, yeah, I mean, the choice ultimately is with the customer and their architecture team, right? What we see our job is to deliver hardened Ethernet products that that don't sell it short, right? That give you all of the features that you expect to have. And in the case of our latest generation of switches, maybe a little bit more, right? We're still the only vendor out there that does shortest path bridging in a hardened switch. So, you know, I think the ability to support a wide range of protocols gives a lot of options to people deploying, and you shouldn't sell that short. You know, Transit Wireless wanted open standards. They wanted classical standards. They insisted all their vendors adhere to that. And that's exactly what we gave them so that they could deploy their network exactly the way they wanted to. And interoperability with the rest of the pieces that put it all together were really important to them.
Well, folks, unfortunately, we've run out of time. You've done it again. You've wasted another hour of the best dang enterprise tech show, according to 9 out of 10 subway tunnels. But, of course, we want to thank our guest today, Rob Hemrick. You know, thank you so much for joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech. Can you tell the folks at home where they can find you, your work, and all the things about the current project you're working on?
Sure. So the website is alenterprise.com. My Twitter handle is at Rob Hemrick. If you happen to be in Detroit next week, you can catch us at ITS Americas, where you can see some of our latest generation of hardened switches, and our customer, Nevada Department of Transportation, will be speaking there. So hope to see you there. We're at booth 119, which is 911 backwards.
Fantastic. Thanks, Rob, for being here. We appreciate you joining us on This Week in Enterprise Tech.
Thanks, Lou. Thanks for having me. It was a lot of fun. And have a happy weekend, everyone.
You too. You too. Of course, folks, I can't do this show without my co-hosts in crime. And I want to thank them for all the work that they do. And, of course, being here today, starting with Mr. Padre SJ. Where can they find you and all your work and what you're up to?
You know, the easiest place is still to go to my Twitter account. That's twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you go there, you'll find out where I am. I normally, unless I'm told not to, I catalog my travels pretty well. Sometimes I even tweet when I'm not supposed to, so you can find out when I'm doing secret stuff. But if you go there, you'll see what content I'm working on. You'll see where I am in the world, and you'll see what comes up next, because I am approaching the end of my time here at the Twit TV network.
Fantastic. Thanks, Padre. I definitely want to thank Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, can you tell the folks at home where they can find you and all of your work?
Well, you can find my writing at darkreading.com. Got an interesting piece coming up next week. I'm going to be looking at the evolution of the Mirai botnet. Lots of interesting things going on there. I'm also going to be attending SAP Sapphire Now at the Orange County Convention Center. If you're going to be at Sapphire, look me up. Week after that, I'll be at Cisco Live. You can always reach me on Twitter, KG4GWA. So please drop me a note. Would love to know what you're thinking about the world of enterprise technology and security.
Fantastic. You guys get to do all the fun traveling. Well, folks, of course, I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially thank you to Leo and Lisa for making and continuing to support us in doing This Week in Enterprise Tech each and every week. Thank you to all the engineers, of course. Thank you to Mr. Brian Chi, our Tyrus producer. You know, also hit him up on Twitter at ADVNETLAB. Ask him if send him some questions, send him some possible options for shows. He's always listening. He's always finding great guests. So definitely check that out and reach out to him. Also, thank you to you. You tune in each and every week. We couldn't do this show without you. And, of course, our loyal listeners. And we want to make it easy for you to tune in each and every week to watch This Week in Enterprise Tech. Go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twiat. You'll find all the back episodes, all of our show notes, guest information, the links to the stories that we do. And more importantly, next to the videos there, there's that magic button. You can subscribe to any format of your choice, whether it's audio, video, HD, audio, HD, video, any device of your choice, your phone, tablet, laptop, desktop. And after you subscribe, also remember, we do this show live each and every week at 1:30 p.m. Pacific time at live.twit.tv. And if you're joining live, you might as well jump into the chat too at irc.tv, twit.tv. And I don't know about you, but if you think about it, the show is really enriched because of the chat room. So you might as well just jump in there too. Also, I don't want to forget, you can always find me at twitter.com/LouMM. And you can find all the things I'm working on, all the cool things. And of course, plus, if you want to see what I'm doing on my daily job, it's dev.office.com, where you can find all the latest and greatest and how we can customize your office experience and become more productive. And before we sign out, of course, I want to thank our TD today. Kevin, can you tell the folks at home what you're doing and how can they follow you and some of the interesting things you're doing?
You don't really follow me, but interesting things I'm doing. I'm roasting marshmallows on lava pits.
Fantastic. Thank you, Kevin. We hope to see you next week. Well, until next time, I'm Louis Maresca saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep twiet.